This is the, I guess, the first EFF panel in here. They moved the earlier panel to another room. I'm Hug Me. I've been coming Dragon Con a long time. I wanted to talk about virus scanners and some of the things that are wrong with them, mostly. How many people here run a virus scanner? Okay, so most of you. How many... Huh? Oh, sorry. Doesn't help that, you know, I put my hand in the way too. So, how many people have ever compared running a virus scanner to not running a virus scanner on your computer? What did you find out?
It's better than not using. Performance issues, memory issues.
Yeah.
At least on my fun tools.
Yeah.
It's on faster.
When you install a virus scanner, and I should make a separation point. Installing a virus scanner is a little bit different than running a virus scanner. A long time ago, when you got a virus scanner, you would never put it on your hard disk. You got a virus scanner as a disk. You'd put the disk into your machine, you would boot your machine up. The disk would boot up, scan your entire machine. You know, it would be able to scan everything, your bootloader, everything like that. And then you shut your machine down, pull the disk out, and boot it back up, and you'd be fine. You've just scanned your machine for viruses. This is how a virus scanner should work. Well, somewhere along the lines, the virus scanners decided that they wanted to be an entire operating system and take over everything. So once the virus scanner goes into boots up with your machine, it drops into memory, eats up, it takes the entire database of every virus, worm, Trojan, everything that's ever come out, and it moves it into memory. There goes half your memory. Now, once it does that, every time you do anything online or over the network, every time you open a file, a program, all of your system programs, every time you boot, it runs against what you're doing on the machine. There goes all your CPU. Now, let's compare that to actually getting a virus. Viruses are made to be extremely small, take up very little memory, take up very little CPU. Usually, they're supposed to be so small you don't even notice them on there. If you scan regularly and update, and I'm going to go over some of this, scan regularly and update, you're going to get rid of them if you get them. And we'll talk about how not to get them and some of the things you can do to keep from having these issues. But basically, what I want to talk, what this is about is, if you want to use your computer and have resources, CPU, memory, have a fast machine, you don't want to run a virus scanner. It just eats up your machine. So first off, let's talk about what a virus is. Does anybody want to try and tackle that before I give a definition?
Are we referring to viruses as strictly viruses, or are we regarding malware in general?
Just viruses. We'll start with that.
A self-replicating damaging program, I'll try?
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's pretty close. Not damaging, though. A virus doesn't actually have to be damaging. In fact, most viruses are not damaging. The first virus I ever got was on an 8088. Does anybody remember those? The old 8088s? It was called the ping pong virus. What it did was randomly, about every 30 days, there'd be a little ball that would show up in the top left corner. And this is when the screen was text only. The ball would show up and it would start bouncing around your screen. And every once in a while, it would pick up a letter and bounce it around the screen and then drop it off randomly in some position. It was fun and cute, and eventually I figured out what it was and got rid of it. But most viruses are like that. They don't necessarily harm your computer. There's a lot of malware now that does, and this is what makes the news and what everybody talks about and things like that. It's a small piece of code. It attaches to a file, a program, something like that, and it has the ability to move from computer to computer in some way. A worm is a type of virus. A worm has the ability to move from computer to computer without a user telling it to do that. normally the way a virus moves from computer to computer is a person has to do something that moves the file that it's attached, file or program it's attached to, from one computer to another. A worm can do that on,
Like an email?
That can happen with an email. It can happen with a website sometimes, if you download something from a website. The Da Vinci virus, if you, any of you remember the giant Da Vinci scare that was even bigger than the 2000 scare, I think. The Da Vinci virus attached to Microsoft Word. All the copies of Microsoft Word for like 3 or 4 months had it attached to it, so you'd get it off your disk. But moving something from one machine to another is how a virus is how a normal virus replicates.
I think you should note that with sites, you don't necessarily have to download; just visit.
That's actually an exploit. It's sort of a type of virus. You do have to pull something from the site, and I'm going to talk about that a little bit. We're about to actually go over zero-day exploits and things like that. A Trojan installs something on your computer, it's like a virus, that gives backdoor access for someone to get into your computer. So if I install it on your machine, what it installs itself and opens a port. You may not even see the port open. I can do a knocking or something like that to get in, but I will have control over your machine even if you don't know I'm doing it. A lot of spammers use this. They gain control over someone's machine so they can send spam from there, and their spam isn't blocked as well, things like that. Oop. I should probably turn off my screensaver so I can read my notes. An exploit is the next one. You'd sort of mention it. An exploit is an actual problem with your operating system or a program. So that the worms use this to self-replicate. So if the way an exploit works is there's, when the coder wrote the program, there's a problem with the program that allows someone to install something on your machine or do something to your machine. They can shut it down, they can do something without you telling them that they're allowed to do it. But it's an actual bug in one of the programs. We'll talk about getting rid of those. A zero-day exploit is something that not many people know about. It hasn't been publicly released yet. So when I say zero-day exploit, it's an exploit that, let's say, in... I'm guessing most of you are Microsoft users. Any Apple users? Okay, any Linux users? Oh, wow, there's quite a few Linux users. So let's use Wireshark. Wireshark runs on just about everything. There are a few exploits in Wireshark. If Wireshark has not released something to fix those exploits, this is called a zero day. And someone can get into your machine before you are able to fix the machine. These don't usually last very long. Normally a zero-day exploit, they get fixed pretty quickly. Once the company finds out about it, it's usually only a couple days before they're fixed. So we talked a little bit about how a scanner works. Running on your, taking up space in your hard drive, eating your memory, things like that. Between 20 and when you install the virus scanner and run it, is 20 to 80% of your computers taken up? 20 to 80. 80% of your machine. Yeah. Especially when you do a lot of networking stuff, browsing the web, things like that, is when the virus scanner really goes nuts.
How do you remove that out of your memory?
You uninstall the virus scanner. Yeah, just get rid of the virus scanner. So, what should we do?
Okay, to uninstall the virus scanner, do they still make the disk or to where you can, like, when you boot it up and do it like...
Usually, they have an uninstall program that will go through and uninstall it, and you just run that. You're asking about the disk that you put in and run to scan everything.
Right.
Yes, most companies still make that, and I did want to mention that.
Is that the recommendation? Is that the route to go to?
That's one of the things I recommend. And yeah, I wanted to go over. So we've gone over what they are. So the next part is going to be, you know, well, if I'm not running a virus scanner, what do I do? How do I get rid of this? The number one biggest thing, and I have five little things that I want that are the most important, but absolutely run your updates. Update your software, update your operating system, keep up to date on everything. The companies fix their stuff. Run the automatic updates on most stuff. If you see the automatic update as being really annoying, like anything Adobe makes. Why I have to update Adobe every 7 days to look at a PDF, I have no idea. But yeah, run your updates, especially for your operating system, no matter what operating system you have. The companies go through and fix these exploits regularly. Microsoft does it. They have once a month, they do all of their updates.
Second Tuesday.
Yeah, second Tuesday of every month. FreeBSD does it every 3 months. They have a full of update of the entire operating system you can do. This is the most important thing you can do with your system.
Do you need to install every single update available for your operating system?
No, you do not, but...
And should you?
It depends on your level of competency. If you're not the kind of person who can go and do expert install and read through every line and find out what every update does, go ahead and install each one of them if you're sure about it.
A continuation from this question. Why wouldn't I update all of what Microsoft says is critical updates of Windows?
What is it called? I'm not a Windows user, but the stuff that is just for their copyright stuff. They're you know, we don't want people breaking copyright, so we're going to give you this genuine advantage. Thank you. That stuff doesn't really need to be updated. If one of the things we did, I see your question. Let me finish up and I'll get you. One of the things we used to do was we had a pretty secure system. We had firewall. This was a work system. We had firewalls and everything else up. We would update our systems on our test machines, wait 30 days to make sure an update wasn't re-released, and then install it on our regular machines.
That's a really long patch cycle.
No, it's not, because a lot of companies will pull updates back within that. We're talking about a 24/7 system that has 65 million users on it. If you install an update and it goes bad, things get bad really, really quickly. So we had a 30-day, and we had other ways of mitigating that. You know, we ran Snort to look for things. We ran firewalls. We ran all kinds of stuff for that. What was your question?
I just wanted to mention that I am a Windows user, but I don't usually update my operating system because it always crashes my computer browser, and I always have to deinstall my browser because I'm not a user of Internet Explorer because of Opera, and I have to do the complete installation of the browser again, and that annoys the heck out of me. So
yes, that's the same thing I was talking about, you know, find out what breaks. But what you might want to do is just install your security patches. So when you go through it, read through, the security patches are the most important ones. You do end up with that sometimes. You do end up with things breaking sometimes. I have the same problem every once in a while. And whenever I install something, I have a whole directory, and I put everything in the whole directory whenever I download anything. And if I have that problem, I go back to my whole directory and I can install it really fast. I don't have to go through the process of looking for it and finding it. And then once I install it, I do updates to that. In the back.
With regard to those Adobe updates that you find so annoying, I think the reason for that may be that everyone I know who has recently had a drive-by download install something that they didn't want, it has been through a PDF exploit.
Hmm. Interesting. So you're saying their software is inherently insecure on top of that?
that is a definite possibility. I have not looked into it in great detail. I just know that when people are getting stuff, that's how they're getting it in the past, say, 2 or 3 months.
Yes. Interesting. Okay, so number two, safe browsing. on top of keeping your browser up to date, just look at where you're browsing. If you're going around looking at hacking sites and porn and sites that are known for having these exploits, do it on a machine that you're going to wipe out anyway. Don't do it on your same machine that you do your taxes on. boot from a CD, exactly. There's a neat little boot thing you can put on a thumb drive that you can just boot from your thumb drive, run it, pull it out, and you know, next time you boot, you're just pulling it off the thumb drive. You're not actually seeing your hard drive.
Actually, as an observation, today, most porn sites are actually fairly clean because the old reputation they had back in the 90s, they've essentially, you know, gone basically tried to subvert that, you know, myth as much as possible.
It depends on
not always
the site.
But
it
the paywalled ones are actually good nowadays.
What I'm trying to
not
separate
personal
is
experience. Money? What?
Yeah, the what I'm trying to separate is going to the DragonCon site, as opposed to sites that you know, companies that you know are going to be fairly safe. If it's not companies you know and you trust, and those are the big ones, are porn sites, exploit sites, sites where you download like LimeWire and things like that, torrent sites, all those kinds of things are people looking to very easily upload Trojans and malware and
if you have LimeWire, your computer is owned.
Yeah, LimeWire has tons and tons of problems.
As soon as you install it, you're
home
at least 2 or 3 months.
By the way, there's tons of seats up here, guys.
Yeah, come on up. Come on up. So just keep an eye on where you browse to. Email. Don't open all of those attachments that everybody sends you.
FluffyKitty.exe.
Yeah, there's so many of those. Thousands and thousands of those that people have emailed around and said, oh, this is really cute. And the thing about it is, some of them that are harmless, and, oh, yeah, I read about it. This is already harmless. It's harmless until it gets in the hands of someone who attaches something to it and resends it. And they look for things that are known to be harmless. So these things that oh, it's okay, you know, it's so-and-so, unless they wrote it themselves, go to the site and download it from a site that you trust. Don't ever install, view, anything like that, any attachment from email.
If your sister sends you something that you don't expect her to send you, don't just hit reply on that one. Mm-hmm. Go to your regular mailbox and send her a new letter and ask her, did you send this to me?
Right. That was actually, thank you. That was the next thing I wanted to mention. Sorry. No, thank you. That's a great segue. The links inside email, when you get an email with a link on it, I can make that link say anything it wants. I can make that link say DragonCon.org and send you to my malware site. It's simple HTML that you're looking at, and you can manipulate it however you want. All the pictures in the websites, I can make them link over however I want. All the stuff that you click on, if your bank writes you, and I'm sure all of us have gotten this, your bank writes you and says, oh, we've lost your password. if you're worried about it and you think it's real, bring up a browser, type in your bank site, and check it. Don't click on any links in the email. Don't touch the email. It's fine to check on these things. Banks get it all the time. Call up your bank. Ask them. don't click on anything inside the email. Emails are inherently some of the most insecure things you can send, unless you're using PGP, which is a whole different panel. there are ways of encrypting email and things like that to make absolutely sure. But unless you're doing that, 99.99% of the people aren't going to be able to do that. Over on the right.
Just as a note, if your bank sends you an email,
it will have your name on it. It will not say, "Dear card member."
A lot of the people who are sending out the emails that are, you know, you say, well, they're dear card member, a lot of them have your name, because they will pull your name. They're pulling these email addresses from things that you fill out, and that's one of the things you fill out is your name. Sometimes they'll have your birthday on it. Anything that you've ever filled out on a card, they can get that information and send it to you. So that's... Yeah, they will do that. I get, to give you an idea, I've had my email, the email address I've got now, I've had since 1995. It's got a ton of addresses connected to it. I get about 150,000 spam every 30 days.
That is awesome, huh?
I can actually bring it up. I can bring up my Gmail account and show you. It deletes it every 30 days. It usually hangs out around 130,000, 150,000.
When you mouse over a link in an email or something like that, and it shows the link at the bottom of the browser, is that a reliable?
I can make that show whatever I want to.
Okay.
I drop a piece of JavaScript in there that brings up a window that says, this has been certified by, you know, Bill Gates and
right.
and Gandhi.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. But in Firefox, it'll show it at the bottom of the window what the link mm-hmm. supposedly is.
Yeah.
So that could be changed. That's not reliable.
JavaScript.
Okay. Thank you.
Turn off JavaScript using those grips.
Yeah. Yeah, JavaScript is a lot of that. Whenever you have a pop up into your browser, shut your browser down. turn on your pop-up blockers so that you don't see them. But if a pop-up does get around that and pops up on your screen, chances are it has a problem. The window that is built for that pop-up, all of those buttons are controlled by who wrote the pop-up. They can write in whatever they want. A lot of them, what they're doing is they're making it look like a pop-up, so it brings it up over the entire screen, shows your browser through it, but then the pop-up, so that it can get the windowing system up at the top, and it looks like the windowing system is inside the pop-up, so when you click on the X, you're actually moving over to their malware site. When you get a pop-up that goes around your pop-up blocker, shut down your browser. Bring it back up. If you're not running a virus scanner, your browser will pop right back up.
how do you shut that down? I mean, if you go up to exit out, isn't that like clicking in and telling it?
Go down to your start
Alt
bar.
Alt F4 works in virtually every operating system.
What?
Alt F4 shuts virtually in Windows, Linux, kills the current focused application.
Not mine, but.
By the way, if you do get something in email and you kind of need to open it, but you're not sure and you want to try to get as safe as possible, this is a site that's operating. We use this pretty regularly when we get files we have to check out. This is a site that runs about 40-some antivirus spyware packages and will scan your file for you. They also keep a database of the MD5s of the files, or the hashes, so that if they've seen the file before, they'll say, yes, we've seen that file before, yes, it's okay or not. And if you get any hits of any kind on this list, which you might get, some could be false positives, I recommend you don't open it. You can also, you notice there's a button there that says submit URL. So if you're going to a site that you're not too sure of, you can click submit URL, and it'll actually check out the site to see if they're doing any weird coding practices mm-hmm. that are kind of bad. We use this pretty regularly.
And this was the next thing I wanted to mention. This is next on my list. Whenever you install something, if you get it on disk, scan it.
Yes.
Use something like this. Scan the disk. This is what the virus scanner is doing, except this isn't loading the entire database for every virus ever written since the 70s into your memory. So this is scanning the disk and then is shutting down. Doesn't take up anything off of your computer or anything like that.
Yes.
Yep.
Now, be aware. Okay, yeah. Be aware that you should be very careful. This actually sends the file to their site. Their site scans it. So be aware that if you are sending internal documents from your company, you've now given them a copy.
And it's if it's a big file, it's going to take up a lot of bandwidth. You know, be aware of all of that as well. There are also most of the virus scanners, if you go to their website, they have, like McAfee and Dr. Solomon and all of those, they have little disks that don't run on your computer that just are made to scan a CD or a DVD or anything that you got that you want to install on your computer. We had another question back here.
Yes, can I get your thoughts on Google Chrome, especially regarding pop-ups and the way it frames them to a tab?
I have not tried, when Google Chrome first came out, I tried it and there were some problems, and this is one of the other things on my list, and I'll talk a little bit about that since you mentioned it. There were some security problems that I found, and I uninstalled it and I haven't touched it since. And I'll talk about some of the little security things that they did. I believe they have fixed that now. And it's a really weird security thing for the way I run things. So I'll touch on that. Yeah.
I was hoping, since you were talking about the emails, you touch on the chain letters or the put your email address in this. We're trying to get it around the world ones. Because if I can just get one person to stop doing that, I feel like I've won something.
Chain letters are fake. I don't care what it says in there. If no one is going to send you money, there's nothing that, no group that donates to people for how many times a letter's sent. They have no way of tracking how many times the letter's sent, even if they wanted to do that. All that stuff is fake. Sometimes it's, most chain letters are not malicious, especially once they're just stupid. There are a few of them that are malicious, but most of them are just, did anyone ever get a paper chain letter? Back when they used to be sent, and those were actually kind of fun because, for one thing, I mean you just throw it away. Not many people send them because you're paying for a stamp and things like that. And I got those; were cute. But once they got into electronic mail and all you're doing is hitting reply to all, and things like that, it just took all of it out.
I pulled the file off this Linux box and set it up. And as you can see, it tells you the results of quite a few packages. And there's the MP5s and the hashes. So you could, in this case, you could go back to the source code repository for Ubuntu and look up the MP5 for that executable and see that it matches, and you know that clean copies.
Yeah, let's say I want to download an EXE, whether it's the EXE or it's wrapped in an RAR file or whatever, and with the intent of sending it to VirusTotal to see if it's okay. Just the act of downloading, am I taking a risk, or am I going to have to actually run it for the risk to occur?
Most of the time, no. If you've kept up with your updates, and you do, there's one more thing on my list I want to talk about, and you do things like that, 99.99999% of the time, you'll be okay. It's less of a chance than the chance you're going to have of slowing down your computer with a virus scanner. So, there is a chance that could happen. But if you mitigate that, of all the people that I've gone over this with, and we're talking, I've done this with multi-million-dollar companies, and I've never had anybody come back and says, oh, yeah, I did everything you said, and I still got a virus. No one has ever come back and said that.
Are there more benign scanners, like everybody knows Norton is a big resource hog, but like my wife got a Trojan that I couldn't fix until I found out about Malwarebytes, and it just killed it immediately. As far as I know, Malwarebytes is not a resource hog. Is that true or false?
I've never used Malwarebytes.
Okay.
Malwarebytes is not a resource hog.
That's what I thought.
Okay.
It's an offline.
Right, right.
Oh yeah, offline scanners are great.
Oh okay.
Are great because they don't run on your computer.
Good.
or they don't stay on your computer. You don't install everything. You're just scanning one object. Those are great. I've totally go for all those. Okay.
What about doing essentially manual scanning? Whole hard drive scan, but
what about doing a manual scan essentially? Norton does the constant scanning of everything.
As long as you're not installing something on your computer that's eating up your resources, great, I'm all for it. So let me go over one more thing, and this is the big one. This is the one that you'll be glad that you sat through the class for. This is the one that will mitigate most of the problems you're going to have. Treat yourself as a hostile user. Most viruses are moved, well, all viruses are moved from computer to computer because of the user, because of the person doing it. They've, except with a few little exceptions of the worms that you know, can use a zero-day exploit and move from machine to machine on their own, it's the user. It's the user that does it. When I say treat yourself as a hostile user, know that you're the problem with the machine. You're the you're what's going to give the viruses to your machine. So, that being said, don't log in as administrator. If you're the administrator on your machine, you have rights to do everything on that machine. Anything you download, anything you run, anything you install has rights to do everything on that machine. Create another user account. Take away all the rights for that user account to install, to touch anything in the operating system. Take away all of those rights. Once you do that, now you can't do anything to it, but neither can anything else you do. If you need to download something and install it, go ahead and download it. Have a directory that you can write to. Download it, scan it. You can go as far as to disconnect yourself from the internet, log in as an administrator, and install it. You've just taken away the ability for the virus to install something on your machine. You can't do it, so nothing you do can do the same thing. This is with the exception of an exploit. This is what's going to get rid of most of your problem. This actually works better than a virus scanner. Because if there's a problem or a virus that is not in the virus database, the virus scanner will not see it. It won't know it's there. It won't understand that it has to do something. By doing this, by treating yourself as a hostile user, you're going to catch it before it's added to the database for the virus scanner, right when it comes out. This really is going to work better than running a virus scanner. And I literally have done this to multi-million dollar companies and run it through. And just last week, I had the owner of one of the companies come up and shake my hand and said, we were spending hundreds of thousands of dollars on our virus scanners and updating them and keeping up with the database, and this fixed all the problems. We haven't had a single problem. Everybody's more productive. We've got all our resources back on our machines. It's the best thing we have, the single best thing we've ever done to our machines. This made us more productive.
How much do you charge to talk to a company?
Depends on where it is and things like that. I actually do contract work doing that. So if you're serious about me coming out and doing that, come on up. I'll give you my information. So
I've heard that often the business versions of a virus scanning program can be a lot less of a resource hog than the personal versions. Is that true?
Only because usually the business person is done by an administrator, and they tend to cut down a lot of the stuff. They install it a little differently. They look at it a little differently. But it's still, you can't run it in the background and not cut out at least 20% of your machine. You're still going to chop off a very large portion of your machine, no matter how much you cut that virus scanner down and have it stop doing things. On top of that, you're eating up resources, updating the databases, things along those lines. If you just take away the rights of the user to do anything, you've gotten rid of all those problems.
I'm an IT professional. I work for a school system, mm-hmm. and I frequently support virus support. And we use a corporate solution. My question is, with a lot of viruses like rootkits, like Vundo, mm-hmm. You don't need rights to get infected. Vundo will infect restricted users. It'll infect power users on Windows XP. And for the most part, users won't notice that. Vundo drops seven character DLLs.
Those are what the scans are for.
Yeah,
but scan it without running in your current system.
Right, but you got to understand a school system. Educating teachers is like talking to brick walls. they are always in transmit mode. So without a corporate solution, we've had worms get on our network, and that's mm-hmm. there's nothing the user can do. Configure, tore our network up one day. What would you recommend for a solution like that? Because you can't train your people.
If you have that much of a problem with people, put in a separate drive or a memory stick or something like that. That's the only thing they're allowed to write to. Yeah, they can't download. They can't.
That's never going to happen because they have to run. I mean, they're using interactive whiteboards and stuff, and they're having to run advanced applications involving curriculum software.
And they're having to connect to the internet.
Yeah, I mean, all this. Absolutely.
Can you restrict where they go on the internet?
When we have web filters in place, we have firewalls in place. We have.
Can you proxy that?
I'm not on the network side. the problem is that we're running full. We're on internet too. We're running full fiber, at least line.
If
our firewalls won't even keep up with our bandwidth, even if we have two $30,000 firewalls, and they won't.
Yeah.
So,
if you want a firewall that's faster, NetScreens are the fastest firewalls made. The cool thing about it is, the actual net screens, they've stopped making them for their newer product, so you can get them cheap. I bought a $5,000 net screen for about $300 a month ago. I highly suggest them. To give you an idea, 65 million users we ran across our net screen 5000s. They're incredible. Also look into IDSs such as Snort. That can find, if you have something specific that you're looking for, you can add its information to the IDS, and it'll block it before it ever gets in your network.
So,
is there an issue with buying used NetScreen firewalls like there is with buying used Cisco equipment with licensing?
The license will come with the fire. There's a basic license that comes with all the NetScreens, and it's eternal. It never runs out.
I know there was a big deal about that. I actually I actually worked for an ISP that went out of business because of that.
And if you make really good friends with some of the NetScreen salespeople, when they come out with a new version of something, they'll automatically send you the newest version of code. So I have all the newest versions of code for all the NetScreens. Anybody else?
Yeah, along the lines of treating yourself as a hostile user,
uh-huh.
I got family, that works on my computer, so I kind of take that mindset. One of the really good things I have found was some sandbox-type applications.
Mm-hmm.
One in particular.
Those are excellent.
Sandboxy. I put that, on my system, run the browser within that, and that, I guess it shims into the OS at a really low level and prevents that process from running anywhere on the disk except a quarantine area.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can selectively choose... Yeah.
Sandboxes and virtual machines are absolutely excellent. That's a little. Most of the time when I give this talk, it's not to very technically minded people. They have a little bit of technology enough to be able to add another user and take away rights, but running a whole sandbox application is a little bit more advanced. But those are excellent. Oh, yeah. Sandboxes are great. I run jails in FreeBSD, mm-hmm. and love them.
Yeah, I haven't had any problems since I've installed it.
Mm-hmm. And VMware. Is another one that's a virtual machine.
Yeah, ESXi you can get for free.
I haven't used that one.
Yeah, it's there's a workstation, then there's a server. with VMware, there's a workstation and there's a server version. The server version is being deprecated, will go out of use next July, I think.
However, there's another version called ESX, very expensive. However, there's a free version, the same thing, called ESXi. The cool thing is you can simulate networks and machines free.
Something to keep in mind with VMware, though, is the fact that there are issues with security issues with VMware.
There actually like, are of all VMs.
Like, yeah. Yeah, well, of course, yeah, but there are exploits to backwards infect from
If you're running a machine, you are vulnerable to something. The only way to keep your machine safe is to turn it off and pour a bag of cement into it.
And even that's questionable.
Two questions. First is XP firewall pretty good? And second, can you go over your five items real quickly again?
Sure. Yeah, I can go over them quickly. XP firewall, I always uninstall it when I get the machine. But I don't suggest that to everybody. I've been doing computer security for 17 years. I think XP firewall is decent for people who aren't technically literate enough to go in and install their own firewall or do their own things. It's great for grandmothers and moms and, you know, anyone who is just wants to get on and look at browsers and email and see their grandkids on videos and things. The five items. Okay. Item number zero. I labeled this zero because it's so important. Update your machine. Your software, your operating system, make sure it stays up to date. Number two, safe browsing. Keep an eye on this, know that if you're going to a site that for something that you're not sure of, not a known company, I want to say YouTube, but they've had their problems too. But not something you know and trust, keep an eye on it. Make sure that
What if you're going to a site and you have no idea whether you know or trust it? I mean, is there some way to know? Just go ahead and check it out.
Yeah, I believe this has a thing where it scans the site as well.
VirusTotal does that, I believe.
Yeah.
Well, what do you think about some of the? I'm one of the people here, like your grandmother, who has no idea what's going on. So some of the browsers have like a little check, says, this is a safe site or this site hasn't been reported. Mm-hmm. What do you think about those? Because I heard they could be kind of hinky.
Those, I hate to say it, but those have been bought out. That has to do with how much money they're willing to spend on getting their name on the trusted list. That's a way
so
for
that's
the virus.
Useless.
Yeah, pretty much. I won't say useless because if they spend the money to get the check on there, then they're probably not going to be running some type of malware. But at the same time, that doesn't mean the site is going to be my site is going to show up as being this isn't a trusted site because I'm not paying them money.
There is another tool plugin for Firefox called Web of Trust, and you see these little green and red dots next to them. You notice the one that says free virus removal scan has a red dot. Users like us go in and find a site and go, "Ooh, those guys are evil," and you can go in and flag them as evil.
Right,
and
but if somebody hasn't flagged it yet.
Yes, however, it's kind of like going down the street and at least you get some information as opposed to none.
Yeah.
And so it does help a little bit. If it is red or yellow, don't go there. Another tool you get is, did you talk about...
Wait, what was that called again?
Web of Trust. Web of Trust. You just go in, it's a plugin, works on, obviously this is on Linux, I run it on Windows too. And it's just a little, there's a thing called defense in depth. And the idea is nothing you do is perfect. So you have a lot of them. So different layers. And the idea is it'll trip across one of them. Hopefully either you or an aid like this. But this consumes like no resources, which is the point.
Yeah.
It consumes browser resources.
It's a little bit of browser resources, but it's minimal. It's not grinding on your system in the background all the time.
Yeah.
Did you talk about NoScript?
No. No, I'm trying to go over basic things I'm not going over the individual pieces of software because there are so many of them.
Okay. Well, there's some favorites, but this one, it doesn't require any talent on the part of the user to know what's going on. It's green, red, or yellow, and it's pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
And
okay, I was going over all the five things. So 0, update your machine. 1, safe browsing. 2, safe email, and there was a lot to that. You know, don't look at what your attachments, everything like that. 3, scan your disks. So use the one of the scanning programs to just scan the disk before you put it in, nothing that runs in on your system. And 4, the big one, treat yourself as a hostile user. So we had a bunch of questions over here. Someone raising their hand right back there? Oh, okay.
I've been installing Windows, you know, for 10 years now, right? Hate me. I used to manage a lab with, you know, over 100 computers. It was for a college. Mm-hmm. And we had 5 people that were in corporate executives. And then we had all the other computers that the kids would get on. Mm-hmm. I never had any problems with my execs at all. And we were running McAfee. But the computers that the kids would get on, I would have to clone them every month because they would be oozing with crap. Mm-hmm. You know? Correct. And I think the best experience I can share is just, you know, be safe with the websites you go onto. I think that mm-hmm. treat yourself as a hostile user of the system is the best advice. Okay, I do have a question. What do you think of the McAfee Site Advisor? Because I've been using it for a while, but I'd like to get your input on that.
Never used it. I don't use virus scanners.
No, this is something like the virustotal.com.
Oh, deal. Okay.
Yeah, you can submit a file and you can...
He uses that more than I do. Virus Total?
I don't use them.
Okay. Thank you.
There you go.
Part of the reason for that is they don't use other people's products. Virus Total is agnostic. It uses everybody's products. Mm-hmm. And all these products have holes in them. So the more you use, the better.
Okay, this doesn't apply to individual users, but for small businesses, I wonder if you've had any experience with some of the network-based threat scanners, such as Preventia, Unified Threat Manager, and things like that.
No, all the network-based stuff I do when I work with a business is IDSs.
Yeah.
So I run Snort.
Sure.
And just
okay. Well, so just make people aware there are appliances that can scan network traffic for virus threats, and so it gives you the virus protection and malware protection without running on the end user's machine.
Right. And NetScreen has one of those too. They're 2000 series. I stuck one of those in. A lot. Those are fairly expensive though. The ones I've put in.
Yeah, I mean they're not for individuals.
Right.
I have 2 small questions. First, you were talking about scanning your installers. A lot of the what you would call free end user license for home use internet applications are becoming streaming installers, mm-hmm. So that you don't have a file to scan. So, I mean, I'm fine, but for the user's sake, what would you recommend installing for that? You know, all of your media plugins, all
trusted
of your
trusted sites.
Yeah,
download them from trusted sites. You shouldn't.
What was the question?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, download them from trusted sites. If there's something that you need, there are a couple sites out there that you can... Let's say you need a new piece of software. A few weeks ago, I needed something that got rid of jitter on videos because we were working with micro helicopters and shooting videos from helicopters, and we got this little bit of jitter as we'd fly the helicopter. So I went to 2 sites, Hot Files and 2 Cows. They do all their scanning beforehand. I trust both of them. Hot Files, HOTFILES. It's run by CNET now, I believe. And then 2 Cows. Hot Files is exclusively Windows, which the machine I was working on at that time was a Windows box. 2 Cows is Windows, Mac, and Linux. And both sites I trust, And that's where I go first if I need a new piece of software. And I ended up downloading three different pieces of software to get rid of video jitter, and one of them worked out pretty well.
Major Geeks is also good.
Major Geeks? I haven't been to that one.
The second question, I had 2 seconds. The second question is, on our network, we run an enterprise solution, virus protection, Sophos Enterprise. It can act as a network access control. It can act as a threat assessment, and it can and limit the user in a lot of ways. That, you know, even though it's using up resources, it gives the administrator a good thumbnail sketch of the network. And we're talking, we have probably 14 buildings and 14 subnets. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we can't get on the ground as easily. Do you think at some point there's a trade-off where the resources?
Absolutely. If you're handing a laptop to someone who is going to be using it in other places, in places, a more hostile environment, not something you can control, you need to look at what you're doing a little more closely. I would steer away from using virus scanners as much as you possibly can. I try to do that. Segmenting the network is a really good way to do that. So if you have a department that's notorious for this, for pulling in viruses or something like that, put them on a separate part of the network. If they want to download a virus and share it among themselves, have fun with it. You're not touching the rest of my network. two cows, yes.
Okay, back here. I have 2 questions as well. What's the best browser to use? And
I didn't go over the Chrome thing, did I?
No.
Well, okay.
And then
anyway, go ahead. What's your second one?
Well, second question is, what's the difference between adware and viruses and/or adware scanners and virus scanners, or is there one?
Adware is a type of virus. Adware is it's a piece of malicious code that goes onto your machine and pops up advertisements when it feels like you need to buy something. And it's just like a worm is a different type of virus. It's just a different type of virus. It has several names, malware, adware, you know, whatever you want to call it. As far as the best browser, it's your preference. I think someone runs Opera over here. Opera's a pretty decent browser. I run Firefox usually. I run Firefox and Lynx. I don't suggest anyone else running Lynx. Unless you're about as nerdy as I am. Yeah, Lynx is a text-only browser. So it's like using DOS and running with just text on the screen, no, nothing like that. It's really nice to run if you're having to SSH from box to box to box, and you don't want to pull a browser all the way across those networks. It's great to run Lynx on the other end. But it's really personal preference. The Chrome thing, is the guy who asked the Chrome question still here?
I'm interested in the Chrome thing if he's not.
Me too.
When Chrome first came up, and my number 4 on my list was treat yourself as a hostile user. When I went to install Chrome, I downloaded it and tried to install it, and of course I couldn't, because I treat myself as a hostile user. It wouldn't let me install it, so I went in as an administrator and installed Chrome and went back as the regular user, and it wasn't there. It only installed it for administrator. And so I wrote them a long letter, and they say, oh yeah, we do this on purpose so that users can just install it for themselves. I'm like, yeah, that's kind of the, that breaks the security of the machine. I believe they fixed that. Okay. Okay, but yeah, since then I'm like, yeah, I'm just going to use Firefox. You know, maybe when they get all the little kinks worked out, I'll try it again.
Okay, when we go home tomorrow, whatever, and we want to do what you're suggesting, mm-hmm. including removing our software that we have, mm-hmm. spyware that we have right now, what's the order that we should do it, and is there anything special we should do to get rid of our virus software?
Create your hostile user first. So create another user account. Take away all the rights. If you don't know how to do it, there are tons of manuals to help you pull rights. So that you can't install anything, You can only write to certain parts of the disk. You can't touch the operating system, things like that. Once you've done that, talk to anyone who regularly runs the machine. Go over the things I've talked about. Say, look, don't log in as administrator. You know, use this other user. You can even create them a separate user as well so that they can put... You're going to do that last. Yes. Yes. So educate everybody who uses the machine so they know. Give them their own user. Show them how to customize stuff so they think it's really cool. And they say, oh, I have my own account. You know, things like that. And then once you feel comfortable, and wait until you feel comfortable doing it, uninstall your virus scanner. Before you do that, I would make sure you have a good backup, which I suggest that if you do anything major to your machine ever, the difference between a working administrator, systems administrator, and a non-working systems administrator is one backup tape. So, yeah. Not really. Run the uninstall program. Usually that works. I know that there were a couple virus scanners that would not let you do that for a little while. They said it was, oh, it's bad. People don't ever want to uninstall their virus program, so that when they click their, yeah, when they click their uninstall, it shouldn't really uninstall. You'll have to read up on how to do that.
There's tools. If you Google name of your virus scanner removal tool, you'll usually find it.
Yep.
Symantec has one that removes everything Symantec has ever made. Norton line, corporate line, all of it. And it's fantastic, and I recommend it for everyone's USB. because viruses could run it is their logic. I can approve having you go online to get it. That makes sense a little bit.
Or at least having to put in the original disk, which they don't even let you do that.
Who has media? Everyone downloads their software now. I had a question for you, and it's kind of question and feedback. Why didn't you mention the caveat of if you have a machine that's regularly in a hostile environment, say coffee shop / airport, blah blah blah, the fact that you feel like it may still need virus protection, and then how much of this would you recommend, or how far would you go with the machine that is regularly? I mean regularly, like probably the way you travel.
Most of what I talked about, I wanted to do this. I wanted to push this towards home users. That's why I didn't really go over the whole corporate thing. A few people asked about it, so I answered their question. But how about if you move their laptop to the laptop? Yeah, that's a hostile environment. But if you go through and do all the things I said, you know, make sure you're watching your emails. Don't go to malware sites. Treat yourself as a hostile user. When you go to the coffee shop with your own machine, they won't be able to do anything anyway. If you don't have any rights, they don't have any rights.
Right. Next question. Just wanted to say a little thing about Google Chrome. Mm-hmm. I must say it's far ahead of any other browser when it comes to security. Architecturally, it's much safer. Every single tab, every single page on Chrome runs in its own process. It is sandboxed. Additionally, the process which it runs under has limited abilities. In Firefox or any other browser, if one of your tabs is infected and exploits the browser, it then has access to all your other tabs, has access to the entire file system. Under Chrome, this is limited. So it's much, much safer than any other browser currently.
I haven't really tested Chrome, so... So that might be.
That's very true.
Okay.
Chrome has a service, at least in Windows, that does its administrative stuff separately and has that even sandbox.
Like I said, when I first installed Chrome, it was a little buggier than I wanted to use it when I first installed it.
I think I have a rule 3A or whatever your browser rule was. When Mr. Director Person there first brought up two cows, he typed in into the... address bar TWOCOWS, and it came up. Mm-hmm. And someone said, no, it's TU, and so he retyped it, and we got this.
Yeah.
The other one looked identical. Two cows may well own the domain to TWO, but you don't know.
Right.
So when you're...
Typically be able to redirect.
Typically. But depending on the size
but
of the site and how.
It was TWO, and yeah. It was this page. Yeah.
It looked like this page. We don't really know. It likely is because
if you know how to do it.
But the point is, use your search engine to find it and go to it. Don't type it into the address bar because people do misspell, and you know, all the time. Sorry.
Don't use the search engine. A lot of times, the fake websites will actually pay for placement.
No, but
has that problem. The fakes of our website actually come up before our own website. So don't use the search engine. Know the real site. Go to the real site.
That's what I'm saying. Go. You know, make sure that the address is the one that of the site you want to go to. Don't go to Wachovia spelled with a K, you know.
We had a question up here, actually. I think she's been waiting for a while.
You said something. I didn't know if it was flippant or why should you trust Adobe, which kind of scared me a little bit because I have to read PDF files all the time. So
there are a lot of PDFs. If you want to read PDFs, I completely stopped using their software for reading PDFs. There is a lot of software out there, and you can type it into Tucows, you know, PDF reader that reads PDF without using Adobe's actual software.
Okay. Do you think Adobe's actual software is like a little has many security holes or is more than?
I just got annoyed with all the updates.
Okay.
Someone
okay,
was mentioning that there are a lot of security problems with Adobe.
Okay.
With I stopped using their software, so I didn't keep up with it anymore.
Okay.
Yes, and actually that's one of the, that's a whole different panel, because we got to talk about, if you want to talk about that, we got to talk about HTML4 and Apple and what they're doing with the iBook, and yeah, we can talk about that for 2 more hours. Yeah.
Yes, have you mentioned Sandboxy?
Someone here brought it up. I didn't mention it because a lot of people aren't quite tech savvy enough to be able to do sandboxing. Sandboxing is a great idea.
Sandboxy, which is
piece of software. No, I have not.
It supposedly is safe and cancels anything that infects you as you come out of the sandbox. Mm-hmm. It's all sandboxy.
There are lots of programs that do that. I am a Unix user, and I use something called Jail to do that. Again, I don't suggest it for anyone else. It's extremely complicated, unless you really want to get into how the OS works and how you're, because you're literally doing recreating your entire operating system as a new virtual machine when you do a Jail. But there are some great programs. Sandboxy sounds like it's one of them. To do sandboxing and things like that if you want to get a little deeper into this.
So what do you do if you do end up getting a virus and you don't have a virus scanner?
Run the separate scan program. You should find it. Some of them will even clean it. Go into Google, either on that machine. I would suggest if you have another machine using it, type in some of the attributes of the virus, and it will tell you all about it. It'll tell you what it's doing, if it's sending spam, if it's doing something malicious to your computer, how to clean it so you can get rid of it. Sometimes it'll have you go into your regedit and get rid of the registry keys, which is a really good way to clean it. It'll also tell you anything malicious that it has done. Because sometimes you'll get rid of the virus scanner. It's like being in a car wreck. Well, you're not in the wreck anymore, but there's still damage to your car. So it'll tell you some of the things that those rock and roll.
I just told you guys were screwed.
This model has a handy battery indicator.
Wow.
I was expecting Hendrix to pop in and start playing or something. Like, yeah! But yeah, it'll show you how to fix those things that is done and stuff like that. And there are tons of websites, so just go to Google, type in some of the attributes, you know, what it's called. Once you run a manual scan, it should tell you the name of the virus, and you can just type in the name, and it'll give you all kinds of information.
I have a simple, very simple question. Is it just easier to download to one machine that runs on Linux?
Easier? It depends on who you are. Honestly, if you would prefer to do that, by all means, I would love to see more people learn more operating systems, not necessarily Linux, but I love it when people want to learn more about the computer itself. Whatever operating system you use, whether it's macOS, OpenSolaris, FreeBSD, OpenVMS, whatever you want to use, I applaud that.
I just have this little machine that I just use for downloads, and it's very small, and it's very easy, and it has no virus protection, and it runs like a clock.
Absolutely. If you want to download it for put Linux on it and try it out and do downloads in Linux and then do an install from Windows, that's a great way to do things.
And I have another question. Mm-hmm. How many browsers can you have on the machine?
As many as you want.
They won't kill each other?
No. Opening them all at the same time, I wouldn't suggest, because it may be a little slow, depending on your machine. But you can install as many browsers as you want. There's some great ones out there. Opera, Chrome, Firefox.
I have two machines, and I have like three running at the same time on both of them.
I do that
Opera
as well.
Opera and Chrome and Firefox.
I do that as well.
Except for Explorer. I don't like Explorer.
I do that as well because I have multiple Gmail accounts, and it's easier just to open up several browsers.
Given your current state of virus scanners on PCs, what do you think about the virus scanners on phones? Phones with mobile OS, Windows mobile OS, Android, which is based on Unix. Would you recommend putting a virus scanner on a phone, even though it's going to do the same thing to a phone that it does to a computer? It's going to kill the resources.
I would have to look at the virus scanner first. Once we get into phones, because there's so few resources on phones anyway, it's possible that some people are going to write some virus scanners that actually work really well, and you can set. Don't run in the background. You know, run as a cron job that runs once a week or once a day. That would be a great way to do a virus scanner.
Would you recommend scanning it? Because all phones are able to hook to a computer somehow.
Mm-hmm.
As a separate drive.
Yeah. Yeah, and then scan what's on it. Sure. Outside scans are great. It's when the scanner tries to take over your entire machine that I really have the problem with. Right.
When you get a new computer, what I'm hearing you say is the only thing you really need to do, if you're the very first moment you sign on, is set up a hostile user. Mm-hmm. You shouldn't have to do anything else. Is that accurate?
Pretty much after knowing all the
other things.
Set up the hostile user. That is going to mitigate most of anything you're going to run into.
How do you feel about ClamAV as an external scanner for Unix Linux based systems as opposed to commercial solutions?
I have not used it.
Do you have any? My IT department at my work has done the network version of Symantec, and I'm convinced that all of our machines are running ridiculously slowly since this has been installed. I've argued about them with this for a while, but do you have any arguments that you would suggest to maybe convince an IT department?
From your point of view, it would be very difficult to do. the best thing you can probably do is get them to have someone come in and talk about the different, you know, the different options that they have. Train the users. I wouldn't suggest going in and doing things like uninstalling Symantec.
I can't.
Well, you can. It just takes a little, yeah. You may get in some trouble. What I used to do was I would convince, because I would work in the corporate IT, or the I would work on our product. We had a corporate IT department that would do our operating system and all, and they would get really upset if you messed with their system. I would just tell them, look, I need to run a different operating system. I need to run Unix. And then I would run my own thing, and I'd be fine. They wouldn't know, they don't know anything about Unix. It's a bunch of Windows guys. From where you sit, it's very hard to get an IT administrator to listen to his staff and what his staff is telling them about their machine. It depends on your admin, though. Start telling them, look, my machine is really slow. I can't work like this. It's killing my productivity. Tell your manager, you know, I need to be able to work. Yeah. Yeah, as soon as the absolute, in any question to deal with your corporation, find a way to mention money. The corporation is there to make money. That's the entire reason the corporation exists. If something is affecting the dollar, it's more important than anything else.
Yeah, in that respect, a lot of corporations, especially the big ones, have a list of software you're allowed to have, a list of software you're not allowed to have, a list of software you must run. And in that department, I have seen a lot of users at my work just say, this software is slowing me down. They're like, what can you do about it? Like, we'll double the RAM in your machine, put you in a 64-bit operating system, so on and so forth. They're much more willing to throw hardware at you than remove their precious, beloved, subsidized software.
Right.
Speaking of subsidized software, for the guy who said about the installing a new machine, go through and find every last piece of junk that Dell or whoever put on your machine and remove it, or do a fresh install.
I always, do a fresh install, for the simple reason that you don't know that when you bought the machine, it didn't already come with something. I always do a fresh install.
Yeah.
No matter what it is, and I you know, make sure everything else that they would have installed is gone.
Yeah, one of the things that Dell did a while back is they let you buy a computer without an operating system on it, and you can buy your, you know, Windows 7 or whatever, and it's more expensive, but it's a lot less of a pain in the keister.
Yeah.
What was my question? how do you guys...
I was going to ask something.
sorry, I was kind of scatterbrained. How do you feel about disk encryption, you know, encrypting your personal files and things like that?
I do it at home. It's a little more advanced of a topic.
Yeah.
If you want to do encryption and you really want to get into encryption, I would suggest running a file server and encrypting your file server, not your PC. The reason why, if something goes wrong with the encryption and you need to do some work to be able to fix it, if it's your PC, you have nothing to work on. You can't even go and look up something on Google. Everything's gone. I always suggest putting all the files you want encrypted on a file server, something that you can work on. Also, if you really are serious about doing encryption, take a look at ZFS, the letter Z. There are two operating systems that use it right now: OpenSolaris and FreeBSD. Did anyone see Randall Schwartz talk the other night? He's the guy who wrote the Pearl O'Reilly books. Last year he was up here spouting how great OpenBSD is, and someone came up and said, what's your favorite operating system? I said, well, I run FreeBSD and he runs OpenBSD, and he looks at me and says, no, I run FreeBSD. I'm like, what? We got into an hour argument about this last year. He says, yeah, the ZFS project. It's a modular file system. and it's absolutely incredible. You can add encryption to it. You can have a file server that exists on multiple machines but shows up as one drive. It does really, really cool stuff. And you can just write a module and throw it at it, and it separates everything out. It's neat. We had a question. There he is.
Actually, I was a follow-up to that. If you're using an encrypted file system, does that create a kind of a drive on performance?
It can. It depends on how you set it up and what you're using. Okay. If you don't, if you see that it, I would suggest setting it up. If you want to get into it, set it up and see if it has, if it's dragging your performance, if it's making it. If it does it just a little, that's fine. If it is, there are cards you can put in your machine that are do all the encryption and de-encryption. Promise makes one of them that's really nice. You just drop the card in, and FreeBSD will seize it automatically. It sees every encryption card. And it does, instead of it running through your CPU, it runs through that card. And so all of your encryption looks instantaneous, like it's a regular file system. And I stream HD video across an encrypted file system.
Also, are you familiar with ButterFS? It's supposed
Butter?
To be Butter. Mm-hmm. It's BTRFS. It's a project that was after a lot of the Linux users got kind of gave up on ZFS being ported over. They started ButterFS.
Okay. Well, ZFS was a project started by, you all know who Sun is, right? it was started by Sun. It was started by this guy who thought he came up with this really great idea for a different way of looking at a file system. He started working on it, and Sun said, "Whoa, that's really cool," and bought it from him. And they started working on it. Well, the guy who runs FreeBSD says, "Whoa, that's really cool," calls up the guy from Sun and says, "This is a neat project. I've been looking for another file system because I don't like journaling. I don't like any of the stuff that's been coming out, but this is really neat. Can I work on this with you?" Well, the guy from FreeBSD ended up writing over half of it. but it was a collaboration among a couple of groups that are very highly regarded in the computer field. And it came out to be absolutely incredible. Like I say, I stream HD across ZFS encrypted. And that says a lot. This isn't a hardware solution, it's a software solution. So we're a little bit off topic at this point, though.
It's really quite easy to use.
Yeah, it is. If you've been doing file systems for a while, which I had been, it's a different way of thinking about the file system and how things work, because you're actually controlling virtual objects, not disks. So you have a little relearning to do, especially if you've been doing it for years and years like I have. I had to relearn how this worked, and it really confused me at first. But once you get the hang of it, it's really neat.
Question. You were talking about you can have multiple operating systems on your computer. Mm-hmm. Do you need something like partition magic to install them so you can keep them separate?
I would suggest, if you want to do multiple operating systems, I would suggest, if one of them is Windows, install everything else first and leave the beginning partition for Windows, and then install Windows last, and then reinstall your whatever you want to boot from. Let me actually, can you pull this over to my machine, and I'll reboot and show you what mine looks like. I use one called Easy Boot. The video, pull the video out and bring it over here. I think I can hook it up to this.
Easy Boot freeware or?
It comes with FreeBSD. A lot of people use, is it still called Lilo?
Grub,
that's it. They renamed it.
Grub 2.
Yeah.
Actually,
Grub 2.
Yeah, it's way better.
Is there a pin bent there?
I don't think so. It's upside down.
No?
Starts it up. Maybe this is dead. No. No, hold on.
There we go. Let's see if we can get this up. I don't know if it's going to show it because I'll be booting across this, but Easy Boot is just that. You don't actually install anything or set anything up, it looks at the drives and says, this is what is bootable, what you can boot from, and says F1, F2, F3. No setting up. If you install something new, it automatically sees it. It's really nice. When you install FreeBSD, there's a way to get around. You don't actually have to use FreeBSD to use it. I don't see, no, it's not coming up. Okay, well, we'll do this. It's a pretty big screen. That's what it looks like. So I've got F1 for Windows, F2 and F3 for FreeBSD, and F6 for Pixie Boot, which is a network booting. Berkeley System Development. Linux has one called Grub, also free. You have to run Linux to use it, though. You do not have to run FreeBSD to use Easy Boot. Yep. Yep. And it does all your scanning. There's no setting up. There's no, you know, with Grub, you have to go and change the file and do all that. None of that. Sees everything automatically. You don't have control over what you can put there, but, you know, you have less control over it, but there's less setup to do. It's really easy. You don't have to think about it. So.
More question. In the realm of safe browsing, what are your thoughts and recommendations on Adobe Flash Player?
It's a necessary evil sometimes. I install Flash Player, and then I have a program that doesn't actually play any Flash unless I click on the play button in the Flash inside the browser. Flash, on top of sometimes having problems with security and things like that, really slows your browser down. If you don't play any of the Flash, like all the advertisements, all that, shut them down. There are a couple programs that do this. But when I see something come up that has a bunch of Flash in it, it just comes up for me with an empty box and a little play button. And it doesn't download the Flash or anything like that. If I want to play it, I click play. You can do a search for these. I believe Firefox, it's one of the add-ons. Go into the Firefox, search the add-ons, and just click Flash.
AdBlock?
What's it called? FlashBlock? That's one of them. There's several of them. There's three or four of them that do that, and they're really nice to use.
I was just asking because I work in rich media advertising, so it's kind of...
It won't stop everything all the time. Definitely
you got Mike
not.
Behind you.
For a lot of simple users, one thing that you can do is just press escape or stop, and it won't stop everything. Definitely not, but mm-hmm. It can help.
Yes.
So it will stop it from taking up your processes, and I use that a lot. Whenever I come onto a page, I was like, I don't need all this. Stop.
Try the Flash Block. Yeah. It works really well for me. The one thing I wish it had was a simpler way to turn it on and off, because sometimes I'm browsing and I want to always see the Flash. But, you know, necessary evils for sometimes happen.
Can you hear me?
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever had any success with NASH? GNAS? It's like Flash, but it's NASH.
I'm sorry, say that again. I was reading.
Right.
Yeah, as far as I'm aware, it's not really quite ready for
prime. Yeah, I've tried it and failed miserably to get it to do basic stuff.
That sounds like a serious experience with anything that's, you know, protocol.
I can put that up on the page.
What, on Pugby.org?
No, on the EFF page.
Okay, well.
I can put up something.
Okay, you can send me something.
Yeah. Sure. I've got to send stuff about the Arduino anyway. Anybody else? We got like 5 minutes left, so.
Bit off topic, but since somebody else had a question. To increase computer knowledge, what would you recommend? The online classes or going to a school or self-education?
It depends on you. How do you learn best? And my mother's a does childhood brain stuff. So it's a lot of about learning and how people learn. Figure out how you learn. Are you a hands-on people?
I always come up balanced on those tests.
Well, I usually do too, but are you better at reading something and then doing it? Are you better at trying it over and over again and messing it up and then figuring out eventually? Are you better at listening to me, to someone speak? Figure out how you learn best and then pursue, look up what other people have done in those pursuits. So if you are best for, you find that you read a book and you gain the most knowledge by reading a book, go and look at reviews for books and find a good book on it. If you get more from sitting in a class like this and listening to someone speak, look up classes. It totally depends on you.
If you're hands-on, buy a cheap computer, break the hell out of it a million
times. Exactly. and that's what I suggest. And so many people ask me that question. They're like, well, you know, how did you learn? Well, I learned because when I was a kid, I used to take this stuff apart and figure out how it works, and I would screw it up over and over and over again. And I would spend 2 months writing a program that really sucked, but I learned a lot from it. but that's just me. Everybody is going to learn differently.
I learned best from watching others do it. So.
Okay. Conventions where they do that kind of thing would probably be great for you then. Look over people's shoulders.
Are you here in Atlanta?
Yes.
Freeside Atlanta.
Yeah, that's
there might be a thing. It's called a hackerspace, and that's exactly what they do. So
mm-hmm.
You might have a flyer in the back
end. Just one disclaimer: if you are doing something to learn about it, and like breaking it apart, taking it apart, fiddling with it, do it with your own stuff. Don't do it with other people's stuff. That doing it with other people's stuff can
equal jail.
Not just equal jail, equal felony. Some cases, you know, which can take out some of your constitutional rights. Felons do not have all the constitutional rights, and there are cases where people have done stuff that was to them innocent enough, and they were trying to be helpful. And because of the law, it backfired on them, and they became felons. So, just a disclaimer: do it to your own stuff.
Also, if you have friends who are into this, talk to them. You know, go say, hey man, can you set this up for me? I want to just watch you do it one time. Yeah, that's a great way to learn, huh?
Yeah, don't be afraid. I mean, the best thing you can do.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, if you're that type of learner, absolutely. Find somebody who does it. Sure.
Actually, it's a recommendation. I am token network admin at a small company just because I've been able to do everything that my company has needed to do. They don't want to spend money on everything. I have 2 XP towers, a Fedora server, and a bunch of laptops. The XPs are home edition. Some of the laptops are pro, and I can only do so much. Basically, I'm just there to solve problems. But mm-hmm. I would like to try and convince them, stop doing that and ruining my life. Because they do it a lot.
Yeah. Depending on how bright they are, sometimes training them can do it. And if not, take away their rights. Take away their rights to do anything on the machine. Then the company's gonna have to pay you some overtime.
Electrocute the keyboards. Could you electrocute the keyboards, like sort of as a learning mechanism?
That equals jail time.
That was my Arduino
it's
class earlier.
It's faulty wiring. She didn't do it on purpose.
By the way, a really good if you want to experiment with stuff and you don't have hardware, you've just been taught really well by Hug Me here on how to protect yourself to keep yourself from being infected. And one of the things you notice is when you have antivirus and you're infected, your machine virtually comes to a complete halt. Most people that aren't here, their reaction to that is, wow, when I bought my computer, it was really fast. It's old now, and it's really slow. They only bought it a year or 2 years ago. And so I need a new one. Now, you're the computer guy or gal.
So, introduce me to those people. They can give me their old machine and
well,
they can buy a new one.
Well, that's exactly where I'm going. Now, you see this computer here that we've been using all weekend for the wall of sheep? That was one of those computers. My neighbor said, I bought this new computer. My old one was too slow. And I'm thinking, you know, if we just formatted and reinstalled it, it'd been fine. And they said, what do I do with the old one? I'll take care of that for you. I've got an entire basement full of mad scientist gear, all free, because my neighbors will happily give it to me rather than have to deal with getting rid of it when I get viruses. So that's a really good source for that.
Yeah, well,
they're not rich.
You should come.
Everybody does that.
You should come see my garage sometime. I have an Alpha 256 running OpenVMS.
Is it still running?
Yeah. I have two IBM PS2s running Windows 3.1.
Okay. Well, let's have a weird hardware war. What's the oldest piece of gear you have?
My oldest piece of gear is an IBM System 1. It has a hexadecimal keypad on the front, and the output is 16 LEDs.
Wow. That seriously kicks my ass.
What do you do with it?
Actually, I've done some really cool photography pieces with it. It doesn't actually run. It doesn't actually run because it's 440 volts. And so I've never been able to turn it on. But yeah, I've done some neat photography and some we did an experiment with encrypting pictures where we take a picture of it and do encrypted pieces of the picture and then email it to someone and they'd have to decrypt it. A couple years ago, I did some nudes around computer equipment, and that was the main piece in it. So I do photography too, and I don't have my camera. So
yeah. Wow, that. Huh. Wow, I gotta go and look at your.
I have my first actual computer. I still have it. It's a Timex Sinclair 1000. It still runs. It's got 2 kilobytes of memory.
Wow. I have to think here. What's the oldest thing I have? Now these are all functional. I mean, they're collector grade equipment. I have an IBM XT original. Ooh. And this is a weird one. I have an IBM brand AT339. Now, for those who have no idea what that means, it's when ATs first came out, they ran at 6 megahertz, which was like 2 megahertz faster than an XT. The problem was people very quickly figured out that they were radically underclocked, so they would put chips in them and do all kinds of stuff and overclock them. Well, IBM said, we're going to get into this. So they came out with their turbocharged from the factory AT339, 8 megahertz. Ooh. And at the time, this thing was a monster. It had 2.5 mega memory and 50 megs of hard drive. I was like king.
My first machine, the Timex Sinclair 1000, I didn't have, it was the one with the tape recorder. Yeah. You hook up a tape recorder and that's where you install all your programs and everything. I didn't have that yet. You hook it up to the TV, that's your monitor. Every time you hit a key, it refreshes the entire screen. Well, I spent probably 3 weeks writing this really complex program that I wanted to do. And at the time, there wasn't really a debugging because debugging took so long. You made sure your program worked the first time. Well, it's my first real large program besides the little test programs ever. Spent weeks doing it. I think I was 11 years old. I was so excited, and I hit the enter button to run it the first time. Well, everything runs in memory. You don't have a drive. You don't have anything that. So everything runs in memory. Well, the first line of the program is supposed to clear the screen so that I can start running everything. The command I put in was to clear the memory.
Epic fail!
Gone! That was my first program ever. Oh yeah.
No, he does the same.
Yeah. So I spent $65 about 3 months later. I bought it at a garage sale broken,
I bought two of them for $1 a piece. These things were selling for about $800 at the time. I bought two of them for $1 a piece because they were both broken. I took them home. I fixed both of them and got them working. And then a few months later, I mean, I was only 11. I'm doing all this off my allowance. I got to pay for part of it. My parents helped me pay for it. I got a 16K memory module that plugs into the back of it. I spent $65 on a 16K memory module.
At least you could upgrade it.
Yeah. Yeah, there was a big tray at the back of it. I think I still have it. My old 8088. It used to be. I think I'm running over. Is the person for the next panel here? Oh, come on up. I'm sorry.